In New York City, I'm in is hashtag Tap Life. We're a professional tap company. And then in Central Pennsylvania, Lady Grace Lovelies. And we do vintage dance and burlesque.
Oh, wow. That's fun. Fun. So what, with your practice, are you with a private practice or, okay.
Awesome. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, that's great. So do you see a lot of dancers in your?
Yeah, we're getting, my boss has been really good with marketing and kind of getting the word out about me, because outside of people going to NYU or somewhere in the city, there's not a lot of us in Northern New Jersey with dance medicine.
Yeah.
We really have at least two or three dancers on my caseload at any given time.
Okay, that's awesome. Yeah, I spent a little bit of time with Harkness Center for Dance Injuries.
Oh, awesome. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I did one of my clinical rotations there. So awesome. I've got a little bit of experience in that neck of the woods. We would go out to SUNY Purchase as well. So we get around a little bit. But
man, I love the Harkness. They're incredible.
Yeah. That's quite an impressive program. Quite an impressive program. So, but a little bit about me. I studied dance up through college. So I actually have my undergraduate degree in dance. Oh, cool. And then I switched gears coming out of undergrad, minored in sports medicine, and then went for my master's degree in athletic training. So I did the entry level route and specialized actually in performing arts medicine. Shenandoah University has a performing arts medicine certificate program. So I did that.
Oh, wow. In Virginia, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah. Have you ever been to the iAdams conferences?
No.
You should go. I know.
Oh, I'm dying to. There's like all these, I feel like there's so many things I want to do.
Right.
And to narrow it down is hard. Like I just went to, there's a Women in PT Summit once a year in the city that just started like a year and a half ago. Okay. I'm trying to like pick and choose which things.
Right. What events? Well, let's see. iAdams was in Houston this year. It'll be in Finland in October. Then it'll be... Hopefully, probably stateside again the following year. So it'd be great. It's a really neat group. So
yeah, I've been enjoying meeting different dance med clinicians like through social media. Like some of them, I found out. Oh, you're in the city. You're right here. I recorded a podcast for Physiotherapy Performance Perspectives.
Okay.
In September, but it's coming out in April. Finally, I've been waiting. So it's been really great to like network with people through social media.
Yeah.
On my own personally, I didn't know anybody else.
Really.
I just kind of fell into dance medicine.
Really? That's fascinating. That's great. Have you done anything with, what was I going to ask? So are you on like Facebook? Because I know there's a dance medicine professionals group on Facebook that's kind of affiliated with iAdams. Have you on there?
Anything that I can, I've tried to like make contact with people.
Yeah. That's great.
Like when I was an undergrad, I'll say this later. When I was an undergrad, I was like, nope, no dance. Don't want to do it. That's not, because I didn't train seriously at all. I took like two classes a week as a kid. It was nothing. And I just didn't want to be like hanging on to my glory days.
Yeah.
That's it. And then very, very long story short, when I started teaching I started dancing at a studio in Pennsylvania and they talked me into teaching. I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I know that. I'm not trained. And like, oh, it'll be great. And it just snowballed. So when I moved back to New Jersey, I was like, what am I going to dance in New York City? And then I ended up in this company. And it's just like, just keep snowballing. So it's great.
That's awesome. Sounds like you got so much momentum going. That's fantastic.
Everyone's very supportive, which is nice.
Yeah, that is good. Yeah, that's awesome.
Like what the other podcast I recorded, because I specialize in tap dance. One of my friends, I only know her through social media, Alexis Sams, who does dance medicine. I was like, oh, no one talks about tap dance. She's like, oh, contact these people. I'm like, okay. And then I recorded with them like a few days later.
That's great. That's awesome. Yeah. Tap dance is definitely a little bit more in the minority when it comes to like the research and stuff. There's very limited research on tap dance injuries and
so much research I want to do. And I actually just happened to meet a physician from Columbia who was just like super on board, but really? I'm trying to get everything like together because being at a small clinic, we don't have any resources to do research.
Right. Yeah.
And like I saw, where was Harkness? I forget. There was some orthopedic meeting. I forget which one. And they posted a photo and they had all the different shoes and they sliced open a point shoe, blah, blah. I'm like, where's the tap shoe? What happened to that? So
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Definitely get some research out there.
Tap is my favorite. Yeah. I feel like when I'm in the wings and I'm like, I'm ready.
Well, actually, I was just going to kind of let it just keep going. So we're just going to go ahead from there. Hey, guys, this is the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This one is Dance, Injury, Rehab, and Prevention. I've got Daria Oler Oler. There you go. Sorry about that. I told you I was going to do it. Daria Oler, she is up in New Jersey. And Karina Nasrallah, she is from Virginia area, but she's now down here with Houston Methodist working with the Houston Ballet. So Daria is Dr. Oler. She is a physical therapist working in private practice there. This conversation is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/dance injuries. sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/dance injuries. So Daria, let's go back to your athletic trainer story. How did you get to where you are right now?
Sure. I feel like I have a very non-traditional path. I think a lot of people know they kind of dance is definitely what they wanted to do. I was an undergrad saying I'm not interested in dance medicine. To me, that was like a separate part of my life. And I just danced for fun. It wasn't anything serious. So I was an undergrad James Madison. And then I decided to go to Seton Hall for physical therapy. And that whole time I wasn't able to keep up with dance classes just because of how time consuming it is being in school. And I was working as an AT at NYU while I was in PT school. And then when I moved to Pennsylvania to do research at Penn State, I stumbled on a dance studio down the street from us and said, oh, great, I could take a dance class. It'll be fun. And it just snowballed. They asked me to teach. And I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not trained in teaching dance. But they gave me a lot of really great opportunities. So I took 8, 10, 12 classes a week. I was trying to learn everything I could about dance. And then when I moved back to New Jersey, I kind of said, well, what am I going to do? I can't keep up dancing in New York City. That's crazy. But I found a company, it's hashtag Tap Life, and a professional tap dance company. I started dancing with them. And at the same time, I was looking for a job. I had done a lot of per diem athletic training work over time. I wanted to move into private practice. And the setting that I'm in, my boss is very, very supportive of me working with dance. Like, that's wonderful. Where I was worried some people might say, dance, that's weird. That has nothing to do with athletic training or physical therapy. So you started marketing to different physicians that, you know, I'm in the area. I can work with dancers. We fortunately have a dance studio a few doors down from our clinic. And it just sort of has taken off from there. And I'm enjoying combining both. Anyone who follows me on social media, I love art and I love science. And I love the opportunity to combine the two of them. I think that's where I have the most fun with it.
All right. Very good. Very good. Exciting. You said you went to NYU for PT school?
I was at Seton Hall for PT school, but I worked at NYU as an athletic trainer at the same time.
That's right. That's right. I knew I missed something in there. All right. Very cool. So we're going to come back to some more of that, talking about just how you got there or how that's played out. But Karina, again, you mentioned Virginia. You mentioned, I forget the name of the university, Shenandoah.
Yeah, Shenandoah.
Shenandoah University. So why don't you go ahead and tell your athletic trainer story?
Yeah, my athletic trainer story. So it's funny, actually, Daria, that you said this, Daria, that I never envisioned doing dance and healthcare. Like, it didn't jive in my mind. So I trained pretty seriously as a dancer up through high school. I was getting to be a junior in high school and trying to decide, okay, what do I want to do? I was either envisioning dancing professionally or just leaving dance behind and pursuing something else altogether. So that concept of merging the two was really foreign to me. But I just happened to Google one day, like, dance medicine. I don't even know where I learned the term, but I like literally just Googled it. And NYU Lengo, their Harkness Center for Dance Injuries definition popped up, their website popped up, and I was doing like a little bit of reading and I was like captivated. I'm like, this is like this perfect blend of dance and medicine. It's not two separate things. So it just kind of piqued my interest a little bit. I was actually in high school when one of my classmates ruptured her ACL doing C-stones in class. And I just remember how traumatic that was. Like, we heard the pop, like the weird angle of the leg. She was crumpled on the floor, tears. It was just like, oh, my, we all knew. We didn't know what had happened, but it was very, very traumatic. And we were all thinking, like, is this the end of her career? And I remember her coming back from her first orthopedic visit. And she was so frustrated. She kept saying, she's like, the doctor kept talking about my injury like I was a football player. And she just really didn't feel like the doctor understood some of the, what made her profession as a dancer unique from that of other athletes. And she just came out from it really, really frustrated. And eventually she never returned to classical dance training. I think that was partially because we were in rural Southwest Virginia. She didn't have the access to the resources or the healthcare professionals that recognize that, okay, well, one, this doesn't have to be a career-ending injury, and two, how do we get you back to what you're doing? And so that was kind of my first interaction with like dance, really traumatic dance injuries. And I saw the need for having healthcare professionals that really understood some of the nuances of what makes dancers as athletes really unique. So that was high school. I ended up going on to study dance at Belhaven University. That was my undergraduate degree. Did a little bit of sports medicine on the side as my minor. Then did entry-level athletic training, master's degree at Shenandoah University. Shenandoah is a little bit unique. They have a performing arts medicine certificate program that I was able to do in conjunction with my master's degree that gave me just a little bit more of a kind of rounded out my experience now as a healthcare professional and looking at some of the unique injuries that we see in dance and what makes treating dance injuries just kind of a little bit more niche within the broader sports medicine realm. So went on to now work with a couple professional dance companies and am new to Houston as of August. So I'm excited to be here.
Very good. One of the things you mentioned was the intricacies of a dance athlete, so dance medicine. So both of you, just share kind of some of the things that make it different from the ACL repair on a football player, which we just got done working with. We actually here at Pasadena, we treat our dance or cheer athletes the same as we would any of the other athletes. And so I want to know what makes them different. I'm not a dancer, so yeah. Enlighten me.
I think one of the big things is the aesthetic of it, where we are perfectionists in how we execute something. The point of movement in dance, or with sound and tap dance also, is you're expressing something. You're telling a story, you're in character, something to that effect. So how everything looks affects how the audience is going to perceive it and how they're going to react to what you're doing. So it's not enough to just be able to do a step. You have to be able to have a certain aesthetic behind it to relay whatever the information is that you want to do. And another thing with that too, I think in sports, you're trying to execute a skill. Can you score a point, shoot a goal, whatever. With dance, it's not just can you do that, say a grand jeté, one of those big leaps in the air. How are you getting into it and how are you getting out of it? It's the whole thing. Can you transition from step to step to step to step fluidly and making it look effortless? And that's a big thing in dance, is always trying to make everything look easy. You don't want the audience to see and feel that you're really struggling inside. So regardless of what's going on physically, the dancer has to get on stage and make everything look nice and easy, which in sports, that's not always the case. You're allowed to look fatigued and that you're struggling. That's okay.
I think a couple other things that make dancers as an athlete unique is the range of motion that they need to perform their skills. So if we were looking at spinal range of motion or hip range of motion, dancers have to do some really, really crazy stuff and get their legs into crazy positions and bend their backs in ways that most people would think just looks contortionist. So we deal with a lot of, we have to work with a lot of range of motion. And so a lot of that will focus on when you have that much range of motion, dancers will lack often stability because they focus so much on getting that range of motion, but the more motion you have at a joint, the less stable that joint becomes. So we spend a lot of time focusing on balance training and strength training to maintain stability around those joints. And that's something that, for example, with an ACL tear in a dancer versus a non-dancer, an orthopedic surgeon will take into consideration hypermobility. If that dancer was hypermobile before the injury, then they'll sometimes change the angle of the graft, the ACL graft, to make sure that that dancer will have that full range of motion back when they come back from that injury. So those are some of the, I think range of motion is a big one that we deal with.
That's a great point. Like with dancers, many, not all, most dancers have knees that hyperextend. So for dancer population, 0 degrees of extension is not ideal. Where for a regular person, that's fine. That's great. So you want the dancer, if they were there previously, to have that hyperextension to get back there. But then, like she was saying, at the same time, not be able to hang out or sit in their hyperextension, but have the control over their leg to be in the correct position.
Okay, so some of the things that you mentioned is the hypermobile joints, right? So if we're doing functional testing for the athlete, so normally the basketball player, football player comes in and I say, I hurt my ankle. Okay, well, we do a squat, we do a lunge, we do a calf raise, we do a couple of different things just to see what can you do, right? So what does that look like in a pre-screening or like a, I just hurt myself, like functional testing in dance?
I'm always looking for, especially with an injury, are they compensating? Like if you were to do a calf raise and dance is called a releve, if when the dancer is doing that on one leg or 2 feet, if they're rolling out or like supinating their foot, or we'll call that sickling in dance, that's really important to look at, like say with an ankle sprain in particular. So not just how are they able to do it, but where dancers are really good at compensating for things to get done whatever they need to. So trying to pick out where are all those little compensations, and not just looking at, and I made this for everybody, not just looking at that body part, but the overall, what else is going on with them too, in order for them to be able to execute whatever the movement is that we're having them do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So looking for compensating patterns, what else do I need to really think about when I'm evaluating?
Yeah. Again, I think going back to range of motion, that's another big thing that we look at. With a dancer, they're going to do, say, what they call demi-plie, which is weight-bearing dorsiflexion. So if they're just bending their knees, if you told someone standing, just bend your knees. In dance, you would call that a demi-plie. You can do that in parallel position or a turned-out position where the hips are externally rotated. And so when I'm functionally looking at a dancer, that's usually where I start, because just from that, I can take a quick look at, okay, what does their ankle mobility look like? Do they have good enough length in their calf muscles to get a good deep demi-plie? Because that's basically the foundation of their dance movements. That's their preparation for their jumps. That is going to be their landing from their jumps. And any kind of power releve where they are going up onto the balls of their feet into that releve position, making sure that they can then come out of it with good ankle mobility as well. If a dancer is on point, I will also really assess ankle mobility the other way. So if they were to point their toes, I want to be able to see, actually we call it the pencil test. So if you were to sit on the bed and point your toes, would I be able to put a pencil on the front of your ankle and have it lay flat? Or is it going to be your foot going to be kind of angled upwards? So on point, ideally you want to see that I could just lay a pencil and it would be parallel to the floor with that dancer's range of motion. So in point, that's another thing that we look at. And big toe mobility actually is another functional assessment that I look at, because that will affect that height of their releve, and that can lead to injuries if they're lacking motion there. Then functionally, I always look at balance. Believe it or not, dancers are not great with balance and proprioception, especially if you take them out of a position where their knees are locked. They cheat a lot. They do compensate where they lock their knees and they lock their joints. Again, trying to stabilize the joints. So if you kind of unlock those joints, they tend to really struggle with balance. So it's always something I'm going to look at. Up the chain is, are they able to stand on one leg with their knee unlocked and balance? Then I throw in an extra component functionally, have them close their eyes. That's going to be similar to what they have to do, say in a performance where it's dark or their light's changing. So those are some functional things that we look at that might be a little bit different from sports. You're never going to have to be typically doing a sport in the dark, but if you're in a performance, the lighting's going to be different, so they can't rely as much on some of those other sensory organs such as your eyes to balance and maintain kind of that proper form.
And going off the proprioception also, I love that you said the pencil test. I love that.
Yeah.
I group that with, even though it's different, the airplane test, which when you're standing on one leg and the back leg is raised and you have the athlete bend forward if they're going to touch the floor. And what we're looking at is the alignment of their lower leg, particularly like is their knee medially collapsing, which we see all the time in dance. And then also in any kind of balance, 2 feet or 1 foot, are they gripping their toes? If you're grabbing the floor with your toes, we call it gripping in dance. And that's usually a really big compensation for something else higher up the chain. If they're not stronger proximally, you're going to see them, their toes trying to grab at the floor to help them. And I'll look at within dance, we have all different jumps and leaps. So can they take off from 2 feet and land on 2 feet? How does that look? Take off on 1 foot, land on two, take off on 2 feet, land on one, or just do a hop where you're taking off and landing on the same foot. Because somebody might be okay in one of those things I just mentioned, but maybe not all of them. And looking overall, like how are they, the quality of how they're taking off and how they're landing. And within dance, you're not all the time just in a nice isolated environment facing the same direction. You might be moving as you're doing a jump or a leap. You might start facing one direction and then end it facing another. And that's going to change the overall position of your body. So looking at their whole body and how are they able to execute the jumps and leaps.
All right. So there's something I've never even thought about, watching the floor or their toes to see if they're gripping when they're doing balance tests. Because normally I don't know, they keep their socks on when they come in, right? But you, for you guys with dance, there's a lot of times where you're barefoot or you just have like those stocking hose, whatever it is, like naked looking socks. And so that's something that I can consider as I'm testing the balance on those kids, saying, hey, you know, are you looking there? So Daria, you got somebody that's gripping the floor with their toes. What is that telling you?
Something else is weak. And usually in my experience is higher up, like at their hip, but, or even just their overall proprioception in their lower leg is not great. So they're compensating. And one thing I'll do to kind of further look into that, and I took this from New York City Ballet's PT. She had posted this or read an article, and she'll have them stand on a block where their toes from their med heads forward is off the block. So now there's nothing for their toes to grab. They're just in air. And then she'll look at now, how are they balancing? If you take out that toe compensation, are they falling over? Versus if they had their toes able to grab the floor, are they able to stand upright? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and really looking at dancers tend to be very dominant in their toe flexors and extensors. So rather than using their intrinsic muscles of the foot, which is really the support work, the support for that arch, so we want to eliminate some of those more superficial. I mean, same as if you're working with, say, a baseball player and you're working on throwing, you know, you want to make sure that those stabilizer, deep stabilizer muscles of the shoulder, that rotator cuff, are working properly and that you're not overcompensating with lats and pecs and deltoids to get that motion. Because really, if that rotator cuff isn't strong, you're going to end up with injury. Same thing with dance. We're just looking down the feet. The flexors and extensors of the toes tend to be those more superficial movers, and dancers can overcompensate by especially being flexor dominant. And so we really want to look at, okay, that intrinsic structure of the foot. Are they able to articulate their toes? If they stand on the floor, are they able to spread their toes without having to lift their toes up at all? Some dancers can't even do that. You tell them to spread their toes on the floor and it's just almost non-existent. And so really finding kind of some of those nuances of the foot to really, really emphasize that, maintaining that structure and intrinsic strength of the foot.
So spreading the toes on the floor, what does that indicate?
So if they can't do it, then you have toe abduction weakness. So we're looking for abduction. And that would be any of those little intrinsic muscles that do abduction. We want to make sure that those are working really well, because that's going to be your base of support for any kind of dance movement. They should be able to spread those toes and really support the structure of that medial arch. So we always want to look to see if that medial, they're able to maintain that medial arch height with movement. So they may be able to, if they're just standing, they may be able to lift, kind of maintain that medial arch. But if you start getting them doing, say, demi-plies or any other movement, are they able to maintain that medial arch height, or is it dropping?
Got it. All right, so we've talked a lot about just the preliminary assessment. What are some of the most common things that y'all see in dancers? And then we'll continue from there. You can continue like how you treat them or some of the uniqueness of in treating those injuries in dance athletes.
So I see predominantly preteens and teens. I see a lot of general patellofemoral dysfunction, knee pain, jumper's knee, however you want to, whatever you would like to call it. And I sort of, when I look at a lot of the kids I work with, they have like, I call them like baby deer legs or giraffe legs. Like they're not stable yet. They're, you know, they're undeveloped kids still. And they're being asked to do all these incredible things that they can execute the, whatever the component is in the air. And they're just really not super stable on the ground yet. Or like you're saying before, and having all of this range of motion, and really, really lacking the strength and stability. Like just for one example, right now I'm working with a high schooler who has low back pain, and I'd seen her previously in the summer. She was okay, and then just came back yesterday actually. And she has a ton of motion at her L3, L4. If she were to extend her back, dancers have a lot of extension range of motion in their spine. The majority of her motion is coming from L3, L4 instead of having a nice curve. And she's not right now great at supporting her core and using her abdominal muscles. So she's hinging at this one segment. So all this motion is coming from this little spot, as opposed to being able to come from throughout her lumbar and even her thoracic spine a little bit. And I'll see that a lot too with kids. They're not great at holding where their body is supposed to be. And they're just going to get motion from whatever the easiest place is that's available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see a lot. I feel like probably 80% of what I see is often foot and ankle problems. really, really big in our population. And I work a lot with, right now, with professional dancers and with the Houston Ballet. I work with their academy kids. So I do see some of those adolescent and young adults. And I think that in that population, I really do see the most foot and ankle issues. Again, I think they're training so much more intensely. They're having to work on point. All of those things feed into a lot of foot and ankle stuff. I see a lot of posterior ankle impingement, or dancer's heel, as it's called. And that's where you're getting really forceful compressive forces on the posterior ankle structure. And that can either just be soft tissue impingement, where it's just basically everything in that posterior compartment of the ankle is getting irritated and inflamed and causing typically loss of range of motion, pain, or there can sometimes be the presence of a bony, an accessory bone in that posterior compartment. So when that's present, it's called an ostrogonum. So that would be a bony posterior ankle impingement. So we do see some of that where they've actually developed an extra kind of accessory bone in the back of the ankle that is now causing trauma to the soft tissues in the area. So I see a lot of posterior ankle impingement. We do see some sesamoiditis a lot with the dancers, midfoot sprains, lateral ankle sprains, pretty much every ligament in the foot. I think I've seen it sprained. It's pretty crazy what they'll do. The dancer's fracture is a fifth metatarsal fracture. We do see that in dance. Most common mechanism for that is if they're landing from a jump and they roll onto the outside or that lateral part of the foot. So typical to what you would see for, you know, a lateral ankle sprain, but I've seen when that fifth metatarsal will actually fracture, or you'll get an avulsion of the peroneal tendon from that fifth metatarsal as well. So a lot of foot and ankle stuff, shin splints. We do see, unfortunately, a number of stress fractures and stress reactions, especially in our young point dancers. That tends to be more something I see through the kind of adolescent and growing years, where you're getting a nutritional deficit as well. I think it's pretty common for these younger dancers, especially if they're going into a pre-professional training program where they are having a significant increase in the number of hours that they're dancing a day. Sometimes if they've moved away from home, so mom's not cooking for them. So they're having to now worry about, okay, are they eating enough? And carrying this increased dance load. So unfortunately, that is something I've seen a fair amount of in our young dance point dancer population. So I think that's a lot of what I see, but back stuff as well, knee stuff. I would say that's a lot. And they've actually found, though, compared to athletes, dancers do not tend to tear their ACLs as much. And they think that that is related to the fact that in dance technique, you spend a significant amount of time training how to jump. So you focus on what are the proper mechanics for takeoff and landing? And most of the time in classical ballet, you're combining that takeoff and landing with rotation or turnout. So now you're adding an additional component of, okay, now you're going to externally rotate at your hips as you jump and land. So much time is taken in the technique class to really focus on those things. They found that there's, compared to, say, like your basketball players, we don't see as many ACL ruptures in dance. It does still happen occasionally, but not as much. So they do have that down.
Let me jump in a little more too. It's so interesting to hear the differences on what we see, like being with a ballet company versus the kids that I see, and preteens and teens mostly. They're just normal kids. They go to school. They're taking, when I ask how many classes you take a week, the number is ridiculous. Sometimes they're dancing 20, 30 hours, literally. And then Saturdays or Sundays, they're in rehearsal a day and they're doing ballet, jazz, hip hop, modern, contemporary, lyrical, sometimes tap. You know, it's just very different. And then with the ACLs, I'm thinking of, because I worked with a dancer 2 summers ago who had tore ACL going into her senior high school. And when I asked what led up to it, it wasn't necessarily this like, you know, I planted and twisted like in sports, but she had been at a month long dance camp that was 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. So she was just fatigued and done, and thinks there was a couple little things ahead of time that had sort of led up to it. which then affected how sleekly she was able to execute all those jumps and landings.
All right, Daria, you had mentioned low back pain. What are some of the things that you do to help treat that dancer? Again, you guys talked about they have to have hypermobility, but again, stabilizing those joints. So what are some of the things that you are doing with that patient?
There is a lot of, I like to think of it as a lot of body awareness, which in generally dancers are typically good with, but they, I'm thinking like this one in particular, no, she's able to do all these crazy tricks, head springs and all stuff. But didn't realize, you know, all this motion was coming from, for her, for, you know, from one particular spot. So taking a big step back where I have her just in the hook line doing a pelvic tilt, which is really difficult for her. Or I have her in quadruped just doing cat camels where she has a lot of extension motion and very, very little flexion motion. And just trying to find like what is the root cause of it. Again, typically going back to having a lot of excessive motion within their spine and teaching them how to properly use their abdominals to support their core and rather than just sort of hanging or falling back into whatever extension-based motion that they have.
I think I would totally agree with low back pain. We usually start with abdominal bracing. So it's crazy that, you know, these dancers have this crazy amount of motion, but if you have them lay in that hook lying position and just try to isolate that transverse abdominis, it is like the hardest thing in the world for them, and breathe at the same time. So even just starting with something as basic as a TA contraction can be very challenging for a dancer who's so used to doing big motions and utilizing all that range that they have, but being able to take out all of that and like, okay, now we just want you to tighten your TA muscle and find what that feels like, and then building onto that foundation. Okay, now that you found that TA contraction, can you just slide one heel out, then the other heel, and just building onto that for a dancer that's not used to kind of honing into those deep stabilizing muscles, that can be really, really world-changing.
Amazing what you see when you go back to like such a foundational movement and they really struggle. But then if you were to watch them dance, they could do these incredible, incredible things. And so sometimes it's easy to miss that if you're looking, say you were just watching them perform. You're like, oh, they could do all this stuff. They're fine. And then just, yeah, just saying, like just the TA bracing, done. We see that often. And looking at the quality of whatever the movements are that are painful, particularly with the back, like, sorry, this girl's just in my head right now since I just saw her yesterday. But I had her do a cambre back, where you're just kind of arching back, and her paraspinals just... they are like popping off of her spine. Like, that shouldn't be happening. This is a very simple, gentle kind of motion that you do, one of the first things you're doing in ballet class. Like, why is that happening? What is going on that's causing that? So again, trying to go back to finding that root, and then with, in particular with dancers, what specific movements, dance tricks, whatever it is, are what's causing it? And then, so what is it with, why is it painful with this and not with that? And then what can we do to fix it? And sometimes, at least with the kids I work with, because they're competing and there's lots of tricks in competition to try to score points, having to have that conversation, like, maybe we need to not do these tricks right now. Like, I had a girl last year who had to do an aerial, like a cartwheel with no hands, in high heels, and she was 14. So, you know, maybe we need to not do that right now. Work on some stabilizing and then come back to it later.
Yeah.
Which isn't always an easy conversation.
So what did you end up doing, cutting the heels off or not doing the aerial?
Well, luckily for her, her teachers and choreographers were okay. They re-choreographed it so she wouldn't have to do that. That's not always an option. Sometimes it is, whether it's competition or performance, you have to do it. Either you're in the dance 100% or you're not in it at all. And that's also being able to talk to the teachers, choreographers, directors, whoever you're working with, and like, what can we possibly modify so this dancer can still dance but be able to do it safely.
Okay, so most of the injuries that I've seen with our dance kids have been ankle, hamstring, or hip injuries. Mm-hmm. And you guys have really kind of focused on lower body things. You haven't really touched much on shoulder. But again, you're talking about doing cartwheels or, I don't know, cartwheels. That's the right word. Forgive me. But doing some of the other things with your shoulders or upper body. So talk a little bit about upper body, and then we're going to come back to how a normal regular athletic trainer like me and not a dance expert like you is going to treat that ankle, hamstring, or hip injury.
I have a good, actually, upper body example. My tap teacher, and I know it's okay if I talk about this, my tap teacher, Hillary Marie, who's this world-renowned tap dancer, last year she was talking about having shoulder pain and was explaining, and I can see this with her, you know, her shoulders are forward, she's slouched a little bit, and with more like a rhythm-style tap dance, not the Broadway, you know, big arms kind of thing. Your upper body's relaxed. This is the style of tap dance I do. You're relaxed. So it's very easy to kind of develop not great posture with that. So we were working a lot, talking about how hard that is, because as soon as she was trying to be a little bit more upright and get her shoulders back, everything kind of tightens and stiffens up, which is immediately going to affect what's going on with her feet, because you need, for the most part, like nice relaxed ankles. So I actually did some mechanical taping with her to help her be able to find where she needs to be. And then it's just like a lot of awareness on her part, as an adult also, which is a little different than working with kids, over time being able to correct it. And then, and completely different, I've seen kids with shoulder injuries because they have to lift their fellow dancers over their head. And again, these are, you know, preteen teenage girls, and all different kinds of things wrong, where multiple girls have someone up over their head, sort of like cheerleading, but not exactly. And whether somebody falls, because I've had that happen, someone fell and then the girl dislocated her shoulder, or they just don't have that strength band. They don't have that proximal stability at their shoulders to be able to safely do it. We have to take a step back in those cases, maybe don't lift that person, and work on a lot of strengthening proximally.
Yeah, I think a lot of the shoulder injuries that I see are typically related to partnering. So both in our guy and our female dancers, guys, it's often associated with some kind of funky lift that they did. And again, we often see that with athletes, you do a lot of cross training for, you know, strength training, and they're in the gym all the time. Dancers, that's not as much a part of the culture. Fortunately, that's something that's changing slowly. But so a lot of these guys that are having to lift, you know, 100-pound, 120-pound girls over their heads and in these crazy positions, a lot of them don't have a background in, okay, like just doing deadlifts and squats and overhead presses with weight. So we see some really crazy mechanics going on. And so a lot of subluxation kind of injuries. We do see just strains in general, rotator cuff issues. With the girls, I do see if they're, I think most of the shoulder injuries that I've seen with some of our females are often distraction injuries where they're having to hold a partner and that partner pulls on their arm and it just kind of slips out, and you've got either a slap tear or some type of subluxation injury related to that. So really focusing, even just especially with our guys, starting with basic lifting mechanics and how do you stabilize the shoulder from the shoulder blade, and what does that scapular humeral rhythm look like? And really, we see a lot of winging scapulas. In dance, I've found, at least classical dance, it's not uncommon to see a significantly decreased thoracic curve. So they are so used to standing up and basically like forcing this upright posture, they will actually decrease their thoracic curve over time. And as a result, you'll often get some crazy winging going on because that those shoulder blades just don't rest against that rib cage really nicely. You've got weak lower trap, weak rotator cuffs. Again, just most of them have never done any kind of upper body strengthening. So showing them how to use their posterior rotator cuff and trying to get those lats to shut off and not be their prime movers and stabilizers for everything is really often where I'll start with any kind of shoulder rehab. For dancers, they do tend to be, it's crazy because you would think of dancers having this great posture, but again, like Daria was saying, just you do see once they're out of the classroom, their shoulders come forward, they're slouching. So opening up the front of their chest, doing a lot of anterior chain stretching and myofascial release to get that open in the front and strengthening all those scapular stabilizers in the back.
If you're working with dancers, this is a random story, but who are performing professionally, my tap dance director has a story, and he was in Tap Dogs, which is the show that tours internationally. I always explain, it looks like tap dancing on a construction set. It is crazy. Like they're suspended, literally tap dancing upside down. It's insane. But there was a part where they were pulling ropes and you were kind of suspended and pulling yourself up and like switching ropes with other people. And somebody else had let go of the rope sooner. Something where like he didn't have enough tension when he went to grab it. And as a result, ended up hurting his hand. So sometimes you can just see very random things you wouldn't think of in traditional dance, but that's very specific to whatever show they're performing in.
Sounds like when I talked to Chad Frazier, he worked with Corteo and Cirque du Soleil, talking about people climbing upside down on the ceiling and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so going back to the regular non-dance expert like me, how am I going to best take care of my dance athletes when they come in with an ankle sprain?
I think one important thing is just to be really open to listening and asking like very specifically, what is it that you can or cannot do now? Like, I think dancers who are working with a non-dance based clinician understand you're not going to know all the terminology and everything. That's okay. But just being really open to like, show me what it is that is difficult or that is painful or that you can't do right now. And not just that isolated movement, but if it's in choreography, what do you need to do to get into and out of that? Where are the problems? And because I think sometimes with the general population, I don't necessarily think ATs or any other healthcare professions, we think of dance as like this easy little thing, but it's very, you know, it's very physically demanding. So just being willing to learn, I think, makes a really big difference. And then also looking at each different style of dance differently, like even again, just listening, like point, what the injuries you see in point are so different than what you're going to see in other styles. Or for me personally, as a tap dancer, we were saying earlier, I get so frustrated because in dance medicine, tap dance always gets, we don't get much attention at all. So really making sure you're considering the unique physical demands of whatever style or styles of dance it is, because what you need physically in point is completely different than what's going to be happening, say, in tap dance, for example. So even if it's just like watching them, show me what you do or show me what you can do right now and where you're limited, and just sit back and watch. And again, just being open to learn from them.
Yeah. I can tell you one thing not to do. If you throw them in a closed basket weave for a point dancer, they will not come back. So something with ankle sprains I've gotten really good at is modifying tapes. I think sometimes we as athletic trainers or clinicians can sometimes shy away from doing taping or bracing with dancers because they do require so much range of motion. But I think there are ways that we can modify, say, an ankle tape that do work with a dancer and that will enable them to get back into the classroom and start doing stuff and give them more confidence. I think half the time that's it. Just a little bit of a reminder, a little bit of a ankle hug to give them the confidence to go back in. So I will always kind of experiment with taping for the dancer. And I will tell them at the beginning, I'm like, this is going to be experimental. Some people like more, some people like less. So if you don't like something if you don't like this tape job, we can modify. So being open to be like, hey, this is going to be a little bit of a creative kind of, see what works for you. And be like, hey, if it doesn't work, come back. We'll try something a little bit different tomorrow. So I usually with, taping dancers, I don't use as much like of your typical white athletic cloth tape. I tend to migrate more towards like Elasticon, more Powerflex kinds of things. And sometimes, again, they're so body aware, sometimes just wrapping up their ankle with a little bit of Powerflex will make the world of difference. So, but being able to kind of experiment and maybe do heel locks and figure eights with an Elasticon versus your white tape, they're going to have a little more motion. Keeping in mind that you can still, what I'll do, for example, with an ankle sprain is may still use white cloth tape on the stirrups because I want to really stabilize that lateral mobility there, but then use, say, Elasticon for the heel locks and the figure eight. So keeping in mind that plantar flexion and dorsiflexion is really what the mobility that they will want the most. But yeah, so I think being creative with taping options is a really good one for that dancer who has an ankle sprain.
Now, it's sort of like a little side note with this too. This is really specific, but like if you're working with a tap dancer, because I see this a lot with kids, to look at their shoes. Mm-hmm. Usually with the point in other styles of dance, this isn't an issue. But with tap dance, with competitions, with kids, they wear these shoes called split soles that literally fold in half. You guys can see this. Like tap shoes should like literally never do this. But this is a trendy thing right now because it lets kids do tricks that they physically otherwise wouldn't be able to do. The tap shoes these are mine, they shouldn't bend. So I'll ask, especially any foot ankle thing, if they're tap dancer, what shoes are you wearing? Because that can make, the shoe I showed you that bends, there's zero support in that. That is not made for the physical demands of tap dance. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, having a conversation about, are we able to change our shoes? Sometimes for various reasons, you know, it's not an option. And if they can change their shoes, well, maybe then tape or brace or something else like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say the same thing applies for especially point dancers. I will almost always get asked about what kind of point shoe they're wearing. We see too often that dancers are trying to cram their feet into shoes because they like how they look. That, again, it comes down to the aesthetic of, okay, how does this point shoe look on my foot, rather than, okay, do I have enough space in my shoe for me to point my foot well? Do I have enough space so that when I go to do a demi-plie, my toes can spread? Or is it so jammed in there that it's basically altering the mechanics of their foot, and therefore leading to an injury? I've seen some compression injuries in point dancers where their shoes are just so narrow that they've just basically jammed their foot in there and done something funky on a turn and really whacked their foot out. And I think a lot of it does feed into the fit of the shoe, and a lot, any type of bunion. If I have a dancer that comes in and they have a predominant bunion, always look at their point shoe and how their point shoe fits. Talk about how are they padding their feet for point work? How do they have a toe spacer? How wide is their toe spacer? All of those things are going to really play into, especially if you have any kind of FHL injury, sesamoiditis, bunion pain, that you really want to take all of those factors into consideration with looking at point shoe fit.
Yeah. One of the things that you mentioned was the taping, and Daria mentioned how the aesthetics. And so if it always wants to look a certain way, does that cause a problem if you tape somebody, but then you see the white tape? I know you mentioned the Elasticon and it's kind of peach, so it might not stand out as much on, you know, like a white person, but I don't know. Does that affect the visual effect? Does that change what you do as well?
Yeah. So I'll often will use a lot of Elasticon or Leuco tape, or I'll get nude colored Powerflex to close it out. And I will always ask to, for most of the time for rehearsals and classes, it doesn't matter. They can wear white tape or whatever it may be. But we do have to have that conversation if they are in a show that is going to affect how I'm going to tape. Are they wearing tights? If they're wearing tights, usually you can do more, get away with more, either whether it's compression wrapping or ankle taping. What kind of shoes they have is going to play into that. But yeah, so I do use a lot of nude color taping, or you can even, if you want to use, if you only have, for example, white Powerflex on hand or white cloth tape, they can always pancake it with makeup. So they can use the same kind of pancake that they would do for their shoes to make them flesh colored. You can do that with white tape as well to make it blend in.
And one thing, I don't have an answer for this, but I'll see, there's a Facebook group in the Dance Teacher Network that I think is like 18,000, something like that, dance teachers related people. And they'll, for kids in competition, they'll say, you know, the doctor recommended this knee brace or whatever, ankle brace, and it's black, you know, most of them are. And what do we do in competition? Are you going to lose points or not? And I'm not a judge, and so I don't know how, I'm sure judges all respond differently to that, but that's just something to consider. And sometimes there are different ways we can tape, just, you know, try to make up for what, not being able to wear a specific brace, and sometimes we can't, you know, and that's also a conversation with the doctor to say, I know they have these physical issues and you're recommending this brace, but they're concerned they're going to go to competition and they're going to lose points. Their team's not going to score as well as they wanted. So is there some sort of middle ground that we can work with for now?
Definitely very interesting, because obviously in a football game, it doesn't matter what brace you wear, what color it is. Now in soccer, they'll make you change your undershirt so that it matches your jersey, and some silly rules like that. I don't understand how that affects the game at all, but that's what they do. So, okay. So we've talked about some of the ways that a normal person can kind of help with the dancer, but what are some of the other, the tips and tricks, and you guys just take it away with whatever dance knowledge, dance medicine knowledge that I need to have, just give it to me.
One thing I've seen, and this is again, the Dance Teacher Network on Facebook, coming from adults, but you know, people post asking questions. They have an injury, one of their students does, they're looking for some input, and I'll see a lot of responses with a lot of non-traditional medicine type things, not, you know, things that we all learn in school, or a lot of push for chiropractors, you know, which is fine too. But I don't often see, if it's a kid, you know, the adult asking, is there an athletic trainer at their school? Or do they have access to physical therapy? For someone in a company, you know, you have medical staff available to you. But in other situations, they might not realize that, you know, athletic trainers do work with dancers and we're knowledgeable. So part of it is just sort of, you know, like with everything else, advocating for ourselves and letting dancers know we're here. And just like with athletes, our job is not to just hold you out and say you can't do this ever again, that we're willing to work with you to make whatever adjustments we need. And our goal is your goal, to be able to get you back on stage performing or competing.
I'm trying to think of any tips and tricks. I feel really lucky. One of the things I like to do, and I realize this is kind of a unique scenario, and most athletic trainers aren't going to have this opportunity, but since I work on site with the ballet, I will go and I will spy on their classes. We've got these great big observation windows at the Houston Ballet. And so I will tend to hear trends, either certain classes or sometimes certain instructors give certain types of combinations, or there are certain rehearsals that are going on and we're seeing maybe a trend or an increase in, say, low back injuries, and they're all rehearsing the same type of piece. And so I like going in and kind of watching their classes or their rehearsals to see what I can glean from a prevention standpoint, and maybe address, like, oh, hey, so I saw you were doing this in rehearsal. I think this might be tying into what we're seeing. So next time we do this, let's practice modifying either your mechanics, or let's make some just kind of tweaks to how you're doing something, to see if we can prevent this injury from getting worse. So I like having that opportunity. I know not everyone will, but that's something that will often give me a lot of insight into the injuries that we're seeing at the time. Yeah.
You mentioned balance training, that some dancers don't have. They're good at compensating, but they don't really have good balance. And one of the things you mentioned was having them stand on a block with their toes off the block, and that'll help see if their toes are gripping the floor. But what else can really works better for a dancer as far as balance? Or is it the same, you know, standing on one foot, standing on a pillow, maybe standing, tossing a ball back and forth? Is there anything specific that helps with the balance part?
I would say all of those things are gonna cross over into your dancer population. That's just basic balance skills, proprioceptive training that I think that population definitely benefits from. I think the only thing that I would throw in, especially as they're getting maybe more toward the more progressed in their rehab, I'll add in that turnout component. So instead of just standing with their toes facing forward on one leg, now I'm going to have them turn out their legs, balance on that one leg. You can add in a dance specific position where they're either their leg is up in a retiré position, where they're having to then bend
like
their
a
knee.
Flamingo kind of thing?
Yeah, kind of the flamingo. Yep, exactly. So they're standing and in that kind of flamingo stance, or if they're adding in movement, like a fondue is a type of dance, classical dance move, where they're having to bend and extend both legs while standing on one. So just bending and extending, even just simple tasks like adding in a porte-bras or carriage of the arms. So if they're balancing on one leg and they're having to move through the dance positions or walk through choreography for their arms while balancing on one leg, that's going to make it a little bit more challenging, a little more dance specific.
One thing that I like with balance, there is a dancer on social media I'm obsessed with, Richard Elsley. And the reason I like him so much is because he teaches his kids how to not compensate, how to not hang out in their knee hyperextension when they're on one leg doing all their crazy tricks. So there's so many resources on social media too, to give you ideas. If you look up professional dances, you'll see them on point, like in their point shoes, on point, on a Bosu, doing a Rond de Jambe en l'air, where your leg is up in the air and you're bringing it from the front to the side to the back, and then they extend to the side. You'll get a feel for like what are common dance moves or positions. So not just, you know, standing on one leg, because we can all do that. Making it a little bit more functional, like what are different movements they have to do in class or in a performance or competition, and how can we add that into like the rehab that we're working on?
Okay, again, we were talking about the balance, and I'm just thinking, like, there's so many times we do a single leg deadlift, but that's another name for it in dance would be something else. I don't even know what it is. Or you're just basically standing on one leg, reaching forward, reaching over with your leg backwards. That's still similar. And then I could also, with the dancer, have her turn her foot out and do that. Mm-hmm. And it seems really, really weird and awkward for me. But again, asking what they're doing, watching what they're doing, maybe talking with the dance instructor and adapting my set of skills to their specific needs. So what are some of the other small things that I can adjust to help with a dance?
Yeah.
One thing, this might not be small, but saying the turnout made me think of this. And I think this might be more working with kids who are still learning and still musculoskeletally immature. When we talk about turnout, so hip external rotation, with kids, they'll see a lot of compensations because, you know, the kids don't recognize the skeletal component of, you only have so much external rotation. Where, you know, if you're built a certain way, you're not going to be able to have that perfect turnout. So you'll start to see they're turning out from their knee or from their foot and their ankle, which causes a lot of problems. So I'll work with kids and like, let me see, just standing normal, first position, which is your heels are together in ballet, your toes are out. And then what is the alignment from your hip to your knee to your ankle and your foot? So if people are, and that even not just in standing, I'll look at this in all the functional movements too, but if they're compensating a lot, you start to see that their toes are pointing one way, but their knee is all the way medial of their toes. So teaching them how to really actually engage their hip external rotation rotators. Mm-hmm. And there's a dancer who talked to me about this, of thinking of turnout as an active thing, that you're not just standing, cranking on your legs, turning out, and using the friction of the floor to hold you there, but you're constantly actively engaging those hip muscles, which I think for children is a little bit difficult. And especially if on top of that, okay, now move. Now go do a plie, go pirouette, go do a leap out of it. But I see a lot of injuries from that compensating because they don't know how to properly use their turnout muscles yet. Mm. And with kids too, they'll look where their toes are pointing. So I'll teach them to look where your kneecap or, you know, tibia tuberosity also. It's like, look where your knee bone, I'll say to them, you know, where is that pointing? I don't want to see your toes look a little higher up because I'm more interested on what your hips are doing, not just the end result of where your toes are facing.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the one thing that I've learned today, first position, toe is your heels together, toes out, right? If I walk away with that, then I'm a winner.
Yeah.
Is that true? Is that true in all everything? Because I think you said a tap. Is that true in pretty much all dance?
Yeah. First all position.
Right. There we go. I'm gonna walk in there. All right, over to first position. Okay. Sorry, not to interrupt you. Okay, so what else?
Goodness. Yeah, I think really selling to dancers, really showing them where they're compensating and where they're weak. Because I think most dancers that come into my clinic see themselves as being very strong, very athletic, very very elite, elitely trained, or able to do pretty much everything physically that you could throw at them. So sometimes I think half of what I do in a session with a dancer is kind of pick that apart and identify like, hey, maybe you're not quite as strong as you think, and getting them to then use that as buy-in for some of the exercises that you're going to do with them. Because if you just show them, say, you know, an ab brace or a deadlift, they're very good mimickers. That's what they've learned to do all their lives. The teacher demonstrates something in class, they're going to mimic or copy that in their own movement. So I think a lot of times training them not to just mimic the movement, but really identify what muscles are you supposed to be feeling. Really teasing apart muscle patterning. That's a big thing I see with these dancers, even with a simple activity like a bridge. They tend to skip glutes altogether. So if you have them laying on the table, you have them bridge up, it's going to be all hamstring. They will probably just skip their glutes altogether. And because, again, they're just mimicking what they're seeing you do, but they've never learned how do I activate my glutes first, hamstring second. So really just even really getting kind of nitpicky with some of the muscle activation, muscle patterning, because from a gross kind of movement perspective, they're going to be able to accomplish almost every task that you throw at them. But it really is, okay, now we're going to do this task, but I want you to feel it in this area first, this, you know, your hamstring second, glutes first, then everything else should be relaxed. I think that's what I spend a lot of time doing with dancers is kind of breaking down what may be simple movements and really teasing out where they're weak. Really see a lot of weak hip abduction, glute med. That's a big one for dancers. They don't like using their glute max at all in anything. They're very hamstring dominant. They tend to be very erector spinae dominant, like Daria was saying earlier. So really kind of breaking down movements. And sometimes with I think most of the time with dancers, simple is often better than complex. And not shying away from those really sometimes basic exercises that we do with athletes, like your RDLs, like your squats, like your bridging activities. And don't even worry about making it dance specific at the beginning, but get them to buy in with like, hey, we teased out that you're really weak in your glutes. You really like to, grip in your hip flexors and your rectus femoris, and getting them to understand the why behind doing a squat or doing an RDL. And then, you know, as they've mastered that, then making it more dance specific. But I think a mistake that kind of a clinician that doesn't work with dancers a lot might make is that, oh, these dancers can do almost everything, but really taking the time to tease it out and get them to buy into what you're doing from a rehab standpoint.
One thing I've seen a few times at AT social media posts is, at least with teenagers, saying a dancer's coming in and she's complaining that her hamstrings are tight. How do I stretch her? Because you could get her leg to her face. And it's even that, as you know, we've said before with this, it's usually not flexibility that's the problem. Mm-hmm. And helping to explain to the kids, stretching, that they've all been doing since they were 3 years old is not usually the answer. And what they're feeling might instead be some hypertonicity, because certain muscles are trying to help to make up for, like, saying, like, the glute med weakness or something else like that. Because with dancers, you know, we want to stretch. Everyone is comfortable. They're happy to plop in a split. And now there are, if you all look up hashtag Tilt Tuesday, you will see how ridiculous the physical demands are now for range of motion, flexibility, and everything. And they're so worried that exercises you do might take away from that, and they're going to lose that motion they have to do kicks or bamas or big leaps, things like that, to show them. But it's really not usually muscle tightness. Something else is weak, and we need to fix that. If we address that part, the feeling of tightness you're getting will actually probably go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do spend a good – I think some of the topics that I spend a lot of time with the dancer population is talking about warm-up. How are you warming up your body for class? Again, kind of the culture around dance is everyone stretches before class. But those of us in sports and medicine know that's not warming up your body. Warming up your body includes an increase in heart rate. It includes the large range of motion. You're getting your core firing. You're getting all of those muscles. It's not a passive. It's a very active activity. It's not passive. But if you walk into almost any dance class before everyone started bar, everyone's going to be hanging out in the splits. They're going to be doing their stretches. And that's really not preparing the body for activity. It's very passive. So getting kind of a shift in mentality to focus on warm up as a very active thing, that I want you to be at the point where you're starting to break a sweat by the time you even start a ballet class. And that takes a little bit of buy-in, but getting them to understand the difference between dynamic and static stretching, and when is it appropriate to use either of those. You don't want to be doing a lot of static stretching prior to class, because there's been a correlation to decrease in power. So that's where I always use, okay, so I want you holding 30 to 45 second stretches before class. You're gonna lose your jump height. Save that for the end of class when your muscles are really warm. That's when your muscles are gonna respond better to static stretching. And we do need to do some static stretching, especially if we've got, you know, Achilles or calf tightness. But making sure that you identify and educating them on when is it appropriate to do that kind of intense stretching, and getting them to, you know, buy into, okay, maybe I should go for like a little walk or do jumping jacks before ballet class, do some planks, do some jogging around the room, arm swings, you know, roll downs, and all of this to get ready for class, as opposed to maybe just hanging out in the splits. So I think warm up is a big topic I spend in that stretching. I think that and with stretching, identifying the difference between stretching joint capsules and stretching muscles, especially with the hips. Teaching them, okay, when you stretch, we want to feel the stretch in the belly of the muscle. You know, if you're feeling a stretch deep in your hip, if you're doing like a lunge stretch, you are probably not actually stretching your quad. You are likely stretching out your capsule and the ligaments around that joint, and we need as much stability there as we can get. So yes, we can work on stretching the muscles around it, but educating them on how stretching the joint itself compromises the integrity of that joint. And you really want to keep those soft tissue structures as strong as they can, as stable as possible, and really focus more on those contractile tissues that we can change the length in. So I think that's a big thing for dancers.
That's a great point too, because for me, working with kids, and especially if unfortunately their teachers don't understand that they're skeletally mature, they're not just tiny adults. You have kids who are Gumbies and like, oh, look what I can do. And I could crank my leg over my head. And I've seen horrible photos of kids and stories from some of my patients where they're not just in a split, but they're, it's called an oversplit, where their front leg and their back leg are propped up on yoga blocks, books, whatever, something like that. And you're explaining to the dancers and the adults working with them, again, the difference, like you're saying, between stretching muscles versus stretching out joint structures, and explaining to that within the joints, once those are stretched out, that's the way that's going to be. And you have this kid who's not skeleton mature, you know, and even with, if the kids are a little older and stronger, are they going to continue a dance? Because once they stop their intensive dance training at whatever age, that joint laxity is still going to be there. And now they're also going to be losing the muscle strength if they're not training. So trying to think in the long term, because it's so easy to get wrapped up and I need to do this right now. My fellow dancers can do this thing. I can't do it. I have to go into this oversplit or this extreme tilt. But understanding, like, we're not just worried about you now, but we're considering you, do you want to dance professionally? Do you want to be a dance teacher, a choreographer? Do you want to do anything with your body when you're older? We have to preserve your joints. Mm-hmm. The flexibility will come. We can work with that, but we don't want to be stretching the joint structures.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. That we've gone through a lot. There's definitely a lot of things I can adjust and look through again. I can remember first position. I can remember the toes on the block, using the turnout, creating the stability, working on the balance, going up and watching the dancers dance and seeing, or just talking to the dance instructor and saying, hey, this is what she has going on. What can she do? What can she not do? How can I best help you? Again, our dance instructor here is pretty close. She comes down, talks to us often, sends kids to us. So I don't think there's a problem with the marketing here just at our school. But in general, you know, just saying, hey, if there's a way we can help you, let us know. Continuing to promote ourselves there. Definitely a lot of great information and a lot of experiences that I don't have. If someone wants to get a hold of you, Daria, you said daria.oller. So it's daria.oller@yahoo.com. You can ask her, you can continue. Maybe if you're in the Jersey area, you can go and do some observations with her and, or even take a class with her, right? If you want to talk to Karina, you can follow up with her, CNASRALLAH@HoustonMethodist.org. And again, she works with Houston Ballet. So if that's something you're interested in, either in ballet or in medicine or in both, like she was seeing her kids with the ACL rupture and then the doctor only talking to the athlete, like the dance athlete, like a football player. If you have that situation going on, just call her and say, hey, what can I do? Or email her and see what can I do? So, right now it's March. So I want you guys to think about an athletic trainer that you would like to thank, right? So think about that for a second. I'm gonna come back to that. I had asked this question on Facebook and said, hey, do you treat the dance athletes like a regular athlete? Do you not treat them at all? Do you treat them like a PE kid? Because with a PE kid here, they don't have a physical on file. They don't have the consent to treat. So we'll basically do first say like, okay, well, you're bleeding here. Here's a thing. Go to the nurse kind of thing. Or like, hey, your bone's sticking out. Let me splint it and we'll call 911 kind of thing. But the overwhelming majority says, yes, you know, they have a physical on file. We have a consent to treat. We treat them just like any other athlete. And, you know, several people were chiming in saying, you know what, they practice more than any other team put together on our campus. And we definitely treat them that kind of thing. And so the majority were either, yes, we treat them, or no, we don't have dance at all at our school or where I work. Mm-hmm. And so I think most athletic trainers in the secondary setting take care of the dance athletes as well. But again, if you don't, here's lots of, we've gone through tons of tips and things that'll help you do that. So Daria, I'm going to start with you, an athletic trainer you'd like to give a shout out to.
Sure. This is, I like this. My undergrad program director, Herb Amato, out of everything, you know, that we've all learned with athletic training, one of my very first days, first preseason before my AT classes started, he was telling me this whole story, but he had said that, if everybody's breathing, it can't be that bad. And that has stuck with me in terms of all of the crazy possible things that we all know we can see. And then I actually was just telling a story on Twitter this morning. I actually did CPR on somebody once and he lived, and I emailed Herb and said, you know what? I was in a situation where somebody wasn't breathing, but it was okay because you taught me what to do and I knew how to stay calm. So I'm very, very appreciative of him.
All right, so one more time, what was that name?
Herb Amato.
Herb Amato.
I did the AT program at JMU.
All right. Awesome. So Herb, thanks for shaping Daria into who she is.
Yeah. My shout out goes to Dr. Jeffrey Russell. He is the director of the Shape Clinic at Ohio University, and he is very much the one that planted the seed of athletic training. I knew I wanted to do this dance medicine thing, But I cold emailed him after his name was given to me. And I was like, hey, I'm thinking about dance medicine. What kind of career should I pursue? And he really planted the seed for athletic training. And I got to shadow him in undergrad. And he's continued to be my mentor through some research and just career development and professionalism. And so I just am really grateful to him for everything that he has done in bringing me this far. And quick other shout out is to Benay Bernera, who is my coworker I get to work with every day, and she's my hero every day.
There you go. All right, so this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/danceinjuries, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/danceinjuries, and that's got their contact information and as much of the notes as I could type in are in there. And again, they're both very willing to talk and both very competent on the subject. So if you have questions, email them. Daria, I know, is very active on social media. Karina said she's pretty much not on social media. So find one of them either way there, and they can definitely help you out better than I can. So for Jeremy, Daria, I appreciate you coming on. Karina, appreciate you coming over. That is a wrap. Thanks, you guys.